Actually, the secret to interviewing is knowing when to shut up and listen. People in general are uncomfortable with silence. They literally teach you in the Bureau, you got to get comfortable with silence, because sometimes the question that you craft or the question that's asked may not be as important as you giving space for that person on the other side of the table to get to the point where they feel comfortable giving you a piece of information. Sometimes that comes from a couple of uncomfortable seconds of silence. And not everybody's comfortable in those spaces where you're silent and the person on the other side of the room is silent, and you're like waiting for them to volunteer a piece of information. That in and of itself, just that one skill, it's got to be the most dividend yielding skill in any interview setting possible. Understanding when to turn into listen mode and just allow the silence to drive the next move.
Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community.
M.K. Palmore's story begins where many transformational leaders find their compass, in service to something greater than themselves. Born and raised in Washington, D.C., during a time when the city carried the sobering title of Murder Capital of the United States, the odds were stacked against his very survival, let alone his extraordinary success. Yet, from those challenging streets emerged a man whose unwavering dedication to service would span over three decades, taking him from the disciplined halls of the U.S. Naval Academy to the elite ranks of the Marines, and ultimately to a distinguished 22-year career as an FBI special agent. As head of the cybersecurity branch at FBI San Francisco, MK led one of the nation's largest cybersecurity investigative teams, battling the most insidious criminals and national security adversaries in the digital realm. Following his FBI career, MK used his cybersecurity expertise to serve as a strategic advisor for some of the most powerful companies in Silicon Valley. Today, through Apogee Global RMS, he channels his wealth of experience into developing the next generation of leaders to transform not just individuals, but entire organizations. His journey from the front lines of national security to the boardrooms of corporate America demonstrates his relentless pursuit of growth.
MK, welcome to Curated Questions. It's good to have you here.
Ken, I'm excited to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. I always like to start at the same point with guests, and that is asking the question, when did you first understand the power of questions?
That's a great question. For me, it came much later in life, I think, than maybe it should have. I understood the power of questions, formulating them, only at the point where I was asked to basically turn into an expert interviewer. So for those folks listening, I did a 22-year stint in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. When I first signed up to become an FBI special agent, I didn't necessarily think about the time that would be spent interviewing people and trying to extract information from them. All I thought about was all the cool stuff I was going to be able to do in terms of, you know, making the SWAT team and responding to bank robberies and working in counterterrorism matters and all of these things that you see in the movies, which, yes, I got a chance to do all of that as well. But when you think about the deliverables and what it is in terms of the expectations for FBI agents, interviewing turned out to be a particularly important skill. You know, extracting information, getting people to volunteer information to you becomes a very useful process and skill set to have. Keep it in your toolkit. Hopefully you get better and better at it over time. And so when I joined the Bureau, I think I was 28 years old. And at the ripe old age of 28, having finished my stint in the U.S. Marine Corps, I left the Marine Corps as a captain. I thought I knew quite a bit, but the FBI does a really superb job of prepping people for what is essentially interviewing skills. It turns out over time, I was not only effective, I was particularly good at it. And I had some great experiences learning how to bring folks to a particular necessary conclusion or to offer information that was helpful to investigations. And it took some skill to learn how to do that. So age of 28, FBI special agent, and certainly it was something that I worked on over the course of my career with the Bureau.
Now, the FBI, my understanding is that when they're hiring, it is whatever the particular need is at the time, whether it's a language skill or different things like that. Do you have any idea of the purpose or what you were brought in for or what specialty you had or
I was brought in under something called the Diverse Skills Program. So folks who come from a background that doesn't necessarily fall into legal, accounting, and in the current state, things like cybersecurity, basically you come from a background where the work skills that you've developed or the professional skills that you developed have thought to be in a position to potentially contribute to the FBI's mission. And so that's the program I was brought in under. I will note, obviously, we're talking about the mid-1990s when I started the process to get into the Bureau. And I will tell you that in my class, my cohort, you show up to Quantico and there's a cohort, there's 50 plus of you who start together at the time it was a 16-week training process. That 16-week process, which now I think is beyond 20 weeks, in my particular class of more than 50 people, I think ultimately we started with 52 people, 26 of us came from military backgrounds. And so all of us from the military were specifically brought in because of our experience and time in the military. At that time, the FBI was thinking that officers from the military would add a particular type. And it always has. You've always been able to find a good helping and percentage of folks who had served in the military as special agents in the FBI. We're sort of a no-brainer for the Bureau. We understand training. We understand protocols, procedures. Yes, we understand how to take orders. We also understand how to lead. And so there are particular characteristics of the special agent for which military people or people with former military experience typically do very well in the environment. And so there were many of us who came in from the military at that point, Air Force, Army, of course, many Marines, Navy, all across the board. And all of us did very different things in our military careers. I was a logistics officer. There were others in the class who had been grunts in the Army or infantrymen and women in the Army. And it was just really a marsala of experience and background. We literally had a rocket science and a scientist in our class, registered nurses. I came to the Bureau and saw folks who had finished and were practicing emergency room doctors who later on decided to become special agents in the FBI. So it's people come from lots of different backgrounds. And it's always kind of thought of, there is a method to the madness, but it's always kind of thought of as like, they're looking for people with kind of a special sauce and special things about their background that might lend themselves well to the environment of the special agent. So folks do come in under language programs who speak particular languages and have the professional skills, but the diversified program had a period where they were concentrating solely on folks from the military, and that's the program I came under.
Gotcha. I would expect that because the military does check all these boxes, it would transition easier for those agents that are coming in with that background.
And typically when I think about, at the very least, the first 3 to 5 years in the FBI, when it was all just special agent on the street, just mundane sort of day in and day out work, it does make it easy. I think when you come from backgrounds where you expect sort of, hey, you know, what's on the ticket for this week? What's on the ticket for today? How many cases do I have? What am I responsible for doing? I'm always very supportive of folks who come from veteran backgrounds because I think we bring something very special to the table in nearly any environment that we go into. But certainly there are environments like federal law enforcement where our skills, I think, really shine in terms of the competencies that we bring to the table and capabilities. And again, maybe we'll get to this. I had a very good career, a great career, even in the FBI by some standards, enjoyed myself and had an opportunity to lead in the Bureau and do all the things that I was responsible for doing and things I wanted to do, like serve in tactical environments, lead tactical teams, that kind of thing. I got a chance to do everything I wanted to do in the Bureau.
That's cool. And how many years again?
22 years.
22 years.
Yep.
Gotcha. That's a good stretch to be able to
check
a bunch of those boxes.
Yeah. It was.
During the initial training, was there, so this is back to questions, was there any particular courses or books that the FBI uses to train the agents?
Yeah, there's a particular course. I'm not sure that it still exists in the same format, but it literally was called a communications course that the Bureau has and delivered to new agent trainees. So you're called a new agent trainee until you matriculate through the training and then get your badge and credentials, and then you become a special agent or sworn in as a special agent on the last day of the academy. There's a course called Communications, and they had senior FBI leaders, folks who had been and spent time in the field, and some of whom had spent particular time in spaces like organizational behavior and leadership instruction and that kind of thing. They literally taught a course on communications. And part of that course was the scenarios surrounding the idea of learning to interview people and not only extracting the interview, but then also how do you document all of that information and put it in such a way that will allow you to then be able to refer to that in court settings if you need to, or if it was in the other lanes like national security, how do you write documents, get them into the spaces that they need to be in, written in the appropriate format using the appropriate language, but interviewing was a component of that.
And for that training, they give you a list of questions and they talk about how to use questions, or what did some of that training look like?
It was a lot of practical hands-on, for lack of a better description. So scenarios where you would practice interviewing someone, you might be given a set of instructions on one end. Like if you're the person being interviewed, they might give you secretly a set of instructions that says, don't reveal any information and be obstinate and present yourself as an obstacle to the interviewer, right? Don't give them anything. So that scenario, you sit down and then you try and figure out ways to navigate a scenario where someone's not giving you any information, or they're being obstinate, maybe they're even being combative and mean, and then you have to kind of figure out how you're going to respond to those kinds of things and stay on track with what you're there to do, which is to get pieces of information that are going to be helpful to the investigation. So you learn how to manage your responses to how people might respond to you. You show up at people's houses, you're an FBI agent. Most people in their lives never even meet an FBI agent, much less have someone knock on your door and say they're with the FBI and that they want to talk to you about a particular topic. We show up at people's homes, we showed up at people's workplaces, we showed up at various places where we knew that person was going to be, or there was a high probability chance that they were going to be there. And so you're caught off guard. Sometimes that, of course, is intentional. And you also have to learn how to speak and interview people in settings, in courtroom settings, or if there's an attorney present, you know, where you want to conduct a line of questioning. So they try and inoculate you to those kinds of environments so that you're prepared for them. But there is no like list of questions. Although, again, this was more than I've been retired now for 6 years. So out of FBI training for more than 28 years, things obviously have changed over the decades, and there could be components of the program that I'm unfamiliar with at the time. But in the mid-70s, that's how they prepped us. It was basically, hey, do some practice interviewing, and when you get to the field, you're going to remember some of this training so that when you're sitting across the table from someone that you think committed a crime or someone that you think has a piece of information that might be valuable to you, hopefully you've learned some lessons, and hopefully you got enough times at bat. I've always found it's all about iterations, the number of times you get in bat. You're not perfect every time, but you can absolutely learn something in every interaction and engagement with people that you take to that next interaction that maybe allows you to get to the pieces of information quickly and or get to them at all, because there's skills that you need to develop that will break down barriers, get the person talking. And if it's a person who has a criminal background who is used to withholding information from law enforcement officials and authorities, and you're interviewing them in a setting, like how do you get to the point where you can actually communicate with them and there's no artificial wall that's put up, and learn that they may have boundaries, but there's pieces of information still even in those scenarios that they're willing to give. And then maybe you come up with some tactics that will allow you to extract even more information from them.
Gotcha. So just quick point of clarification, as you're going through that, you said the mid-70s, meant mid-90s, right?
Mid-90s, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, just, yeah.
No, I feel that old. I'm not that old.
You mentioned something that'd be interesting that I haven't really spent much time thinking about, is modulating the interior climate when you're, I don't know if this would be considered an interrogation or having these conversations. And whether it's hitting resistance or if they're coming back just more aggressive, what were some of the ways that you kept that even keel. This is assuming that you weren't playing the bad cop that I've seen in movies, but this is more of trying to set aside all of Hollywood raging through my mind right now. But it's the, you know, if you keep asking questions and they're recalcitrant and they keep bumping back, what are you doing internally to keep your cool?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that movies do a disservice is the depiction, I think, oftentimes of FBI agents and federal agents in particular, in terms of interview settings. First of all, that the Bureau over indexes on ideas like not only keeping your cool, but understanding you're there to do a job. Yes, you can get personally vested in an investigation such that you want to see it come to its natural conclusion, but you're there to follow the law and follow the evidence to wherever it happens to take you. You're not there to invent things, or you're not there to drag information out of people or anything like that. It's really about, and again, this is maybe just an FBI thing, it's almost about creating an environment where the person or persons on the other side of the table feel that by releasing that information to you, that you're going to do right and justful things with the pieces of information that are given. So losing your cool is not even a thing. Like, I never sat in the box with another FBI agent, had them lose their cool or me lose my cool. Like, it doesn't happen because we're so guarded, or I was when I was an agent, so guarded against that depiction inhibiting your ability to ultimately have a conversation with them. I'm not there to be the person's friend. I'm there to have a conversation with them, give them at the very least a sense that I'm there to do the right thing, right? And I'm going to create an environment where we can have a conversation. And if there's pieces of information that they choose to share with me, I'm going to do with that information what I need to do to take the next step in an investigation. And it's not going to be used to hammer them or take them to task, even in confession scenarios. And I was lucky enough, I say off the top of my head, maybe 5 cases where I got both verbal and written confessions out of folks that ultimately resulted in them doing time in a federal institution. Like, it was me creating an environment where they were ready to take the step to share with me information that was prejudicial to the outcome in an investigation. And never was it a result of things like yelling and slamming your hand on the table or getting upset or mad about something. And in fact, I think the reasons why the FBI enjoys such a positive outcome in interview settings is because, again, as a workforce, you are told, taught, and you guard against the idea of you coming across as anything like comical or something you might have seen out of a movie or something. It's about a calm interaction and then navigating that conversation to the point where you've gotten the pieces of information that you need.
I was just listening to a podcast the other day with Ocean Vuong, the poet, and the conversation went far deeper than I think both the host and Ocean intended or expected it to go. And I would expect that, or in regard to that particular podcast, it's called The Daily. I highly recommend you check it out. It is an amazing episode. But it's about creating that safe space.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereby you can now open up. And I'm thinking in the circumstances that you're doing, if somebody has something to hide that's sitting on their head, and to be able to work through conversation, through questions, probing and using some of the techniques, whatever you're using, to be able to get to that or be able to communicate that it's a safe space and develop the reassurance and the trust. Yeah. All within this conversation, to me, would be an amazing set of skills.
Yeah, no, it's challenging to say the least. And you just hit on a particular word or phrase. 2 things, actually. One, back in the mid-90s, we weren't using terms like psychological safety, but that's what it was that we were talking about, creating an environment with psychological safety so that the person on the other side. And remember, the vast majority of interviews that are done are just information seeking. They're not necessarily elevated to the point of a quote-unquote interrogation, so that they are mostly about information gathering. And if you want to gather pieces of information, you're not going to move to piss somebody off or put them in a defensive stance in order to be able to get information from them. You actually want to have a calm conversation to the degree that you can with someone so that you ultimately get the pieces of information that you need to take that next step, figure out the next person to interview, figure out who you need to, what evidence might be existing somewhere where you can go get a lawful court order to retrieve it. All of those things are compounded. The vast majority of interviews are done in people's homes, on a sidewalk, outside, like wherever it is that you can engage and get in front of the person where they're willing to have a conversation with you. And then there are, of course, some limited interviews that are done in settings like an FBI office or at a police station or something like that. So it's psychological safety, and you touched on it, the idea of trust. And building that trust, sometimes it could take time. You know, you have someone voluntarily sitting for an interview. You might spend 45 minutes to 50 minutes, maybe an hour, building trust between you and that individual such that they know that this is not a personal endeavor for you. You're not out to get them. You're working a job, an assignment, a case that requires you to gather information. They might have information that's helpful to you. And you could have someone, quote unquote, dead to rights, where the evidence is just overwhelming in an investigation. And you're pretty sure, with very little disparity, that that person in all likelihood is the person that you think is good for a particular crime. Even in those environments, you still have to create a level of comfort and psychological safety so that they feel comfortable at the end of that sharing with you whatever it is that they've done. And that's what it is. And people don't share information with you unless they trust ultimately that you are the person that you claim to be and that you're going to do with that information what you said you were going to do with it. And in some instances, yeah, that means that that person ultimately is going to, in all likelihood, go to jail for some period of time. But even with that as the end state, if you can build trust, if you can build that psychological safety in the interview setting, give them a reason to want to tell you the truth, you can really be successful at doing that again. And I think the FBI has a really good track record of that.
Reflecting back, what set you apart, or why do you think that you were successful?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. When I showed up at the Bureau, I was already what I would call an effective communicator. I had spent time as a Marine Corps officer being a communicator. I had teams that I led. I had to communicate with them. I had briefings that I had done for senior executives in the military. So I was already an effective communicator, and I took it upon myself to get as many, I call them iterations or at-bats, whatever you want to call them, reps for the athletes out there, as many opportunities as I could to sit and watch folks and then subsequently get my own opportunities to conduct interviews. And so anything that you do, it's literally like, you know, what is it, the 10,000 hours rule that Gladwell established. The only way you're going to get better at something is by doing it. And you have to lean into opportunities to learn, even if that means you're not going to be good at it and maybe even going to screw up. And so I've always been one to sort of raise my hand and lean into stuff that makes me feel uncomfortable. And that's how I get good at it.
So that uncomfortableness, when you do that, what is the motivation that you have for leaning into the uncomfortableness?
I want to learn. I want to learn, and I want to get good at something. Because I'm a believer in my own ability to learn and adapt. And so if I trust that there is no topic, no situation, no scenario where I can't go in and actually learn something from it, and or if I listen good enough or if I study hard enough, I can actually extract information and then be able to relay that to someone else. It's helped me a lot in life taking that approach. It's how I got into cybersecurity ultimately, leaning into something that I was ultimately uncomfortable with, doing a bunch of studying because I graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. I know how to study. I know how to break out a book and dive into it and extract principles and then be able to apply those principles in a test format. I have a lot of confidence in my ability to operate in uncomfortable spaces only because I'm fairly confident that at some point I'm not going to be uncomfortable. At some point, I'm actually going to be one of the voices in the room that deserves to be heard on a particular topic because I've not only educated myself, but I've spent time in the trenches. And now with a combination of both academic and practical experience, you then develop opinions, right? And I've learned over time that my opinions, which are the result of that experience, studying, practical experience, learning, that kind of thing, my opinions ultimately are just as valid as anyone else's because I've combined those elements. And I always feel I'm going to get to the other side of that in any one particular scenario or situation.
When did that process and that confidence start?
Yesterday. No. No, it's developed over time for sure. I think as I became a senior executive in the FBI, And I began to realize that the expertise that I was developing as a executive, as a special agent, was unique and something that not many people had the opportunity in their lives to experience. When you embody that and you begin to embrace it as a part of who you become and who you are, it gives you a tremendous amount of confidence when you walk into rooms. I've always been actually criticized for my overconfidence. Like, some people don't have an appreciation for it. But when your confidence is the result of deep experience, you can use that to your advantage any day of the week. If you're going to take the time to do the hard work and gather the experience, then for darn sure, you should be confident about what it is that you bring to the table.
I want to even further investigate that.
Yeah.
Because imposter syndrome is rampant.
It's a real thing, for sure.
As this is for me in my life, but also looking at it just even broader, that ability to have the confidence to understand that you did some work, you did some study, you prepared, you knew who was going to be in the room or the settings, and then overcome the butterflies in the stomach through however many reps that it takes over the course of growing. But it's still a superpower.
I don't know if it's a superpower, but it's definitely a skill. And I have conversations about this topic with people a lot of the times. I do a lot of public speaking, sometimes big stages with hundreds of people in the room, sometimes small environments, conference room with only a couple of people sitting around the table. I've had to develop a lot of skills. I've had to do a lot of reps in order to be in a position to get up on a stage and address hundreds of people.
Yeah.
I still get butterflies, but I also have ways that I quell those butterflies before any particular engagement. I have some like little tricks of the trade that help me, MK Palmore, get over those butterflies so that when I take the stage, I bring to the event the confidence that I was describing to you, that I'm the one who should be there briefing these people and providing information on that particular topic. It develops over time, and a lot of it is mind talk that you have to develop to encourage yourself to get over things that would prevent you from being effective in environments like that. And that mind talk can be immensely helpful if you learn how to structure and prepare yourself for those types of events so that when you walk out on the stage, you're standing fully in yourself, your experience, your expertise, what you bring to the table, and that you figured out a way to convey that and communicate about it in a way that's interesting. You got to keep people hooked, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the same time, they have to get a sense as to, you know, this guy or gal really knows what they're talking about.
Yeah. So what are a couple components or examples of mind talk or any of your other strategies?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, a lot of vision setting stuff, little things like understanding what the event space looks like before I walk into it is really important to me. I do not like to take the stage and have that be my first sight of what the room looks like. So I make it a point. If I show up a day before an event, if there's time that day or early in the next morning to see the event space, I like to see the event space, and then I literally go through like a vision exercise of me positively delivering the address, keynote, talk. I see myself walking the stage. I'm a little bit of a drifter on the stage. I don't like standing behind a podium. I feel more comfortable walking, using my hands. That's why I always have to have a particular type of mic so that I can be comfortable in my own skin before I get up on the stage to address people. So a lot of vision setting mentally. I like to, again, see the space, walk it mentally in my head, see myself giving a positive delivery. I mean, even to the point of me imagining what the reactions of members of the audience are going to be like. There used to be an old adage. I'm sure you remember this from, we're roughly same generation. People used to say something silly like, imagine the audience naked, right? Before you got on stage to disarm you to who they are, right?
Yep.
So part of my exercise is envisioning what their reactions are going to be to certain themes or things that I'm going to say during the course of the talk. Like, I see them mentally engaged in the talk. You're always looking for the folks who are going to nod their head at some of the comments that you make so that you know that I'm connecting with someone out there in this room full of people. Someone understands what it is that I'm saying, and that gives you the confidence to move forward through the talk. And a lot of it is about developing a level of confidence and comfort in your communication style, your delivery style, and then understanding that there's a reason they ask you to be up there on the stage. You're the expert, right?
Yeah.
There can be lots of opinions in the room about the topic that you're delivering, but they asked you to come talk about it because you're the expert. And believe it or not, having that little mind shift, I'm the expert here. I'm the one that's been asked to talk about this topic. There may be people who are going to counter things that I say, and I always encourage people, like after the talk, if there are things that you want to discuss further, feel free to come up and let's have a discussion about it. But more often than not, just that little mental shift, I'm the expert. Here's the room. I'm going to own the room, right? Mm. People miss that a lot. You got to own the room. You got to learn how to read people's signals in the room. I find that comes in handy a lot of times in conference settings, reading people's body posture. How many times have you gone into a conference room setting and started to brief people and people take out their phones and start swiping through their phones? You've lost them already, right? And you got to figure out how to get them back. In a conference room setting, I might throw a question out to the group and then ask the person I just saw swipe on the phone, any thoughts on the question that I just posed?
So yeah.
They're caught off guard, but now they're forced to come back and engage. And when I get them back, I make sure I don't lose them again. Often, and I'll be very candid with you, oftentimes, I think it was one of my colleagues in the Speakers Bureau space, just posted something about identifying yourself and who you are prior to engaging in your talk. And there's a lot of different thoughts about this. And I've experimented over the years, like, do you run through your CV before you give a talk so people know who you are? Or do you just jump right into the topic to make sure that you grab them? And I think you got to do a combination of both. I find it interesting, especially in the leadership space, that there are a lot of people out here claiming to be leadership experts, leadership coaches. And when you look at their background, like you don't see that they've led any teams anywhere. That there's nothing in their professional background that would lead you to believe that they've actually done leadership, like the real gritty aspect of leading people and failing and succeeding and doing that kind of thing. So I'm always on the lookout for stuff like that. So while I don't do one or the other, I don't jump right in and I don't immediately give my CV, I do find ways to weave in my personal background because I know, one, it's of interest to people when they hear it. And if they didn't know my background, once I told it to them, they're interested now in what I have to say. And I have to figure out ways to weave that in a way that captures them. And sometimes in a briefing environment, you got to lay some of that the top level stuff out immediately. So I work in the tech industry full time as well. I'm a cybersecurity leader at one of the biggest technology companies on the planet. Like their name gets people's attention. And then when I tell them where I've been before, that locks them in. Now they're eyes are wide open, ears are wide open. And they're like, what does this guy have to say? Because he's laid out his background. They have him here for a reason. And I want to hear what he has to say. Now, it's my job to keep them on that hook now that I've got them. And I'm not always perfect at it. But I will tell you that sometimes you got to lay those foundational pieces down just to get people's attention and get them engaged. And again, I've experimented with both ends of the spectrum. Again, I land somewhere in the middle and I like weaving in certain things about my background to make sure that people are engaged and listening to what I have to say.
Now, how might you use questions in your preparation for a talk that you're going to be doing or something that you're pulling together?
Yeah, for me, it's all about the audience and what expectation has been set for them. What are they here to hear about? What do they think is going to be presented to them in a customer meeting? Sometimes I feel like there's no limit to the number of questions you should be asking and prepping for a customer meeting because you want to hit that meeting exactly where the customer is so that you can deliver to them the pieces of information that they came there to get. And sometimes there's not enough prep in the way of questions that's done in that regard prior to those meetings. I might start off a meeting with asking questions of the people in the audience so I can understand what it is that they want to hear from me. And not everybody feels comfortable doing that. You know, we've gotten to a point in professional circles that you spend time putting together the slide deck. You have all this information that you think people are interested in hearing. And, you know, by hook or crook, you're going to deliver that deck no matter what. I've gotten to be pretty good at reading the room. I like to come in at the very least 10, 15 minutes prior to my talk so that I can see where the audience is in terms of their engagement. I'm watching people. You know, the executive or the lead for the customer team is not even paying attention. Like that kind of stuff you have to take note of because when you step up there, they're going to do the same thing to you unless you change the environment and atmosphere in the room. So I might start off the conversation with, you know, tell me about a potential problem that you're experiencing. What's the pain point that you have around this particular issue? and then call on people. Like, I need you guys to engage here, because if you don't engage and my role is just to deliver these 25 slides that I prepared, that's boring to me. I'm not interested in that. I can talk for an hour without a slide deck. That's not interesting to me, to build a slide deck and to go into a room. What's interesting to me is having a conversation about something that I believe I can be helpful on. And then at the end of that, me getting the sense, either explicitly or implicitly, that my conversation helped drive an outcome or will potentially help drive an outcome. I'm not interested in presenting decks. I'm beyond that at this point in my career.
Yeah. Delivering something that makes a difference, such that that a decision can be made.
There you go.
And now off we go.
There you go.
Yeah. Change can happen.
And oftentimes that starts with questions, right? Because I have to understand where you are so that I can join the conversation at the appropriate level and point that you're expecting. Mm.
Excellent. All right. So let's go back to FEI.
Yeah.
Any particular questions that you found helpful, or lines of thinking with questions that you found helpful in your conversations with folks?
Let me offer this, Ken, and maybe this resonates with you. Actually, the secret to interviewing is knowing when to shut up and listen. People in general are uncomfortable with silence. They literally teach you in the bureau, you got to get comfortable with silence, because sometimes the question that you craft or the question that's asked may not be as important as you giving space for that person on the other side of the table to get to the point where they feel comfortable giving you a piece of information. Sometimes that comes from a couple of uncomfortable seconds of silence. And not everybody's comfortable in those spaces where you're silent and the person on the other side of the room is silent, and you're like waiting for them to volunteer a piece of information. That in and of itself, just that one skill, it's got to be the most dividend yielding skill in any interview setting possible. Understanding when to turn into listen mode and just allow the silence to drive the next move. Because what you're relying on is that the person that you're interviewing is uncomfortable in that silence. And then they are then going to volunteer information to you, because people hate that silence. They got to fill the space. There's space now in the room. We got to fill it, and I'm going to offer this piece of information. Now, that piece of information may be a lie because they blurted out something because they just felt completely uncomfortable. And you have to have a sense of what that looks like so that you can eventually get to the truth. Hmm.
And I don't know who the attribution is that it's let the silence do the work.
Absolutely. And that can be uncomfortable in professional business settings, right? Because as I just told you, maybe I start off a conversation with customers and I ask a question and no one volunteers a response. Like, I got a long way to go with that group. Like, they don't even feel comfortable jumping in and spontaneously answering a question. That means there's work to do. So I might have to navigate and figure out something else to do. Maybe I describe a scenario and then say, does this resonate with you? Is this something that you experience in your own organization? And someone, oh yeah, you know, that's happening all the time with my team. X, Y, and Z, here's how we are dealing with it, or we don't have the answer for it. Can you help us figure that thing out? Sometimes you got to learn how to pitch stuff out to just generate a level of trust that they feel comfortable speaking with you. And I found that to be super, super interesting, even in environments where there may be a cultural or a language barrier to folks opening up and actually having conversation. All of those things matter, and all of those things that you have to take into account in both professional and especially in professional business settings when you are trying to deliver pieces of information that are going to be helpful to outcomes.
I shudder to think how much work would need to be done within an organization if you came in, ask a question, and no one pipes up to answer. I'm like, that place does not have emotional safety.
No absence of emotional safety, and then maybe no one feels ownership of whatever that topic or question is such that they feel compelled to answer it. That's a problem too, right? Maybe I've asked a question about, here's an example. I, in some way, shape, or form, in every talk that I give, I always have a leadership question posed in there, and I ask people to raise their hands. And when I say leadership question, I mean to ask people whether or not they are in either a position of leadership, do they lead teams, and in the cybersecurity realm, I always ask people, who are the cybersecurity folks in the room, right? I might be in a room in a cybersecurity event where only a handful of people raise their hand. I'm like, I thought cybersecurity was everybody's job. Everyone in this room should raise their hand, right? And then they sheepishly, oh, you know what? You're right. Yeah, I'm in cybersecurity too, even though I work in HR, right?
Yeah.
Things like that to just sort of make sure that we're all level set on the expectations. In ownership of topics, it's not always a problem. More often than not, you'll get someone who's like, hey, that's my lane. That's my domain. I own that. And they'll engage in the answer. And sometimes it's important to do that so you can identify in a room of 10 people who your real audience is. If I go into a room of business leaders, CIO, CISO, CFO, CEO, and others, and I am squarely talking about cybersecurity, it's not too long before I understand who the folks are who feel vested in the topic of cybersecurity, because those are the ones who are interacting with me, asking the right questions, pushing me a little bit on my stance on a particular issue. And then more often than not, I find CEOs to be just kind of probing. Like they want to probe. They want to make sure they understand the issue, drive it to the next level. Where's all of this going? Ultimately, what kind of position do we need to be in to protect against stuff that's going to happen in the future? Where security practitioners are squarely interested in, does your technology work? What examples do you have of it working for other people? And can it be helpful to me in the problem that I just described to you?
What questions are not being asked often enough in the cybersecurity world?
How much time we're spending on leadership development. That's sort of my personal passion topic at the moment, as you know from conversations that you and I have had offline. It's interesting. Technology space is a super dynamic place to be in at the moment. Lots of fascinating conversations going on about where technology is going. Obviously, nearly every conversation is all things artificial intelligence. You know, my day job, I work for a large technology company. So a lot of the mentality of the folks who are at that company is very engineering, very development focused. So it's very, I would call it scientific. And I think concepts like leadership or people-centered leadership oftentimes are not discussed or talked about as much as it should. And I should be fair, I see that across the board. It's not just the technology space. Technology just happens to be where I've spent the past decade plus being engaged. But it's happening in nearly every business vertical. I mean, how many people complain silently or to others about poor leadership that they see in the organizations that they work for? Poor leadership can be just really demeaning, a demeaning experience for people. And people give people credit. Like when you're making an effort to engage and have good leadership practices, people are like, more often than not, they're like, you know, this person's trying, you know, they're trying their best. But when you see bad leadership, or you, unfortunately, I know there are folks out there who work for poor leaders at this moment, like that can be so, like you can't wait to get out of there. Like you got to figure out how to get to another team. You got to figure out how to go someplace else so that you're in an environment where you feel like you can thrive, develop, and learn. And I think we're not asking enough questions about what we are doing to develop the next generation of leaders, specifically in the technology space, but I would say that's happening across the board. Leadership as a topic is looked at as a luxury. Most companies and corporations, if they've got deep pockets, they've got a leadership or a management development program. If they don't have deep pockets, no one's thinking about bringing in a leadership team to help them develop their leaders. All they're thinking about is shipping product. That's it. How much of it can we ship? How much of it can we sell? How much of it can we make? When times are lean, stuff like leadership gets put by the wayside, and there's arguments to be had. Maybe some philosophical, others not so much, that it should be one of the first things that you invest in is the development of your people.
Post 9/11, I had been working for Hughes Network Systems as a technical trainer and learned definitely that in the world of when budgets get tight, training goes away. And then at what point do you cut it back on?
Yeah.
Is it because it's now a crisis that things have gotten so bad that it's like, man, we got to fix this because the wheels are coming off? Or is it, okay, we turn this off for a year. We know we have to turn it back on, even though budgets aren't where we want them to be, but we got to, at least there you have a cognizant awareness of the value that it was providing for the long-term sustainment of the company or the organization. Otherwise, it's just going to be a crisis most likely that's going to bring it back in.
Oh, and again, to be fair, I am having conversations because what I do with Apogee Global, which is part of my passion topic in terms of consultancy that I run, I am having conversations with leaders of small to medium-sized organizations who understand its value. And oftentimes there's a little bit of a trick to coming to a price point that, folks understand where it, the value of it or the return on investment is worth whatever number it is that I might pitch or describe. But some leaders out there understand this, and they don't all come from military backgrounds or anything like that. We're just talking about there are some folks out there who are paying attention to stuff like this and are like, you know what, I just had a major shakeup in my leadership team. Now might be the right time to bring in a consultant and have conversations about team dynamics and just making sure we understand all of who we are when we show up in a room, because that's going to allow us to work better and achieve greater outcomes. And so there are some folks thinking about it. I don't mean to, create the impression that no one's talking about it. I just don't think we're talking about it enough.
Certainly with the rise of AI and where it's at today, there's a lot of unknowns ahead of us. Actually, I just watched a clip by Darkish Patel that he was talking about that we may be seeing the last of the human CEOs, but just that concept of lots of big changes are ahead and how this is going to affect organizations.
I think that's a true statement. And that's not bold. That's not a bold statement to make. I think that artificial intelligence may be the most disruptive technology of our lifetime, maybe for our generation. I continue to be bullish on it because I think over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see advancements across a variety of business verticals and domains that are just going to blow our minds because the ability for folks to learn, digest information, and then take steps forward, but we now have a force multiplier. And for the folks who understand that AI is this force multiplier that may allow you to take larger and more frequent steps forward as opposed to all the steps back that we normally take in a research or a development cycle. For folks who understand that value proposition, they're the ones who are going to come to the table with new and inventive technologies and results that we just didn't think we were going to see in our lifetime. And I just really think that's going to happen over the next 3 to 5 years. I'm excited about it because some of the work we're doing at Apogee has to do with how can we make use of artificial intelligence as a learning model. We hope to come to market with a AI-driven scenario and simulation device or platform that will allow us to really have deep substantive leadership discussions. And as long as people are thinking about how do I use this tool and how it's not there to take jobs, it's there to make you better at a particular job. And once you've figured out that play, that it's going to make me better at doing X, Y, and Z, it'll make you better at doing X, Y, and Z. And that means you're going to be more productive. You're going to be able to move faster. And that's how we're thinking about it at Apogee. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we can bring to the table as it relates to AI-related leadership instruction, because I think that we're right on the cusp of seeing some very interesting things in that space.
What step would you encourage folks to take in understanding that element better?
Yeah, it's interesting. I just had a conversation with a senior executive about this topic. He, like me, is very bullish and has been leaning into the use of AI as a tool ever since it was sort of reintroduced to the public now more than 2 years ago. And we feel like there's a spectrum, or I feel like there's a spectrum. There are people who are so hesitant and just don't really understand the value of use cases. And they're on one end of the spectrum. They're not using any AI.
Yeah.
Then there are people maybe like me who are just, I'm trying to think in every instance, how can I use AI to move faster at this or get better at that? Like that's the other end of the spectrum. So like we got to figure out who those folks are in the in-between and really galvanize them. And it's all about leaning in and taking that first step. And then once you've seen how it can impact a process or something that was previously laborious for you, once you've seen it in action, then you become kind of a true believer. And then you want to explore it more. You're like, how can I leverage this even more to do things faster, better, more frequently? And it's going to take, I think, other folks maximizing those use cases and then publicizing it for people to understand that there's value in it. I see a lot of market disruption coming too in the way of like data-driven analysis and jobs and things that AI seems to be able to do in a matter of seconds. And these are things that used to take organizations weeks, if not months, to get done. So there's a lot of disruption coming. And then some of it's great and good, and the others of it mean that people are going to get displaced. And it's incumbent upon all of us to figure out how to leverage these advancements so that we can be ready for those shifts when they happen.
As I've used a couple of the different tools that are out there, I've definitely been impressed with how much easier the tasks are that I'm going after, how to use it as a companion, if you will, or right. that way. And I certainly oscillate between the, well, this is great. Oh no, what does that mean? This is great. Oh no, what does that mean? I'm like, okay. And I don't know if that's the optimal state or what that looks like going forward, but we know that it's here to stay. So to me, it's embrace and start your pivot from knowing that the carburetor is going to go away.
It's here to stay. And you know this, as a podcaster, you and I both have podcasts that we do. Podcasts have been making use of some level of AI effectively, at least for the past 18 months or so that I've seen on the market. And that gets even better, I think, from week to week. There are now so many new vendors on the landscape where you can take a piece of recorded video and actually make other useful digital assets out of that piece of recording. That used to be a labor-intensive thing for some of the video engineer who then had to go through it meticulously. We've been on the hook for almost an hour here. Someone would have to listen to that whole thing and extract the pieces that they need and then cut that into video that's useful. I mean, now with AI, you upload the entire video, it cuts it into the reels that you think might be helpful, puts the captions on, and then delivers it with your brand kit and your items on it. And that's a level of disruption that I think people need to get in front of. People are using these because it's making people's jobs easier. It's making those tasks easier. And the quicker you get in front of it, you're leading how it's going to be used, and the more effective I think you're going to be ultimately. But yeah, there's a lot of industry disruption, I think, that's on the way. And again, a lot of that's good. And some of it is going to be challenging for people, to say the least. Mm.
It just released a conversation that I had with Kevin Kelly, futurist technologist, senior maverick at Wired magazine. And he just talks about the disequilibrium point that you need to have, where if something is alive, it needs to have disequilibrium such that if you don't have that, then it's static and it's dead. Historically, some of that chaos or disequilibrium that you have may be your competitors or different elements. Now you have this AI element that could be another layer of this, but this can also be your friend. So now it's, okay, how can I use that strategically for the growth of my organization or for the particular team that I lead?
Yeah. And you just described what would be a succinct level of advice that I would give anyone. Lean into it and figure out how you can use it to make you better at being a team leader. Use it to make your team more effective. Like, lean into this, because if you sit and wait for it to be given to you, like packaged and ready to go for you to use in a particular way, someone's already experimented with it and put into place and learn through iteration how to make effective use out of something that you've now waited to use. That means they're ahead of you on the maturation scale and maybe even productivity scale. So folks got to get in front of this. Again, maximize your understanding of it and then play with it. Like, figure out how to best utilize it so that it helps you do things that, again, maybe you've been resistant to doing up until this point. In fact, if you haven't already experimented, you can go into, and I've done this before for, like, I moderate a lot of discussions. I might take the abstract for a discussion that I've written and take that abstract. One, AI will make the abstract better. It always does. I would tell it to refine the abstract. And then I will give it a prompt that says, generate a set of question sets dealing in these particular categories, which I understand fall within the bounds of that domain or abstract. And it does a pretty good job of developing questions that will spur a conversation. Like, that's amazing. How much time did the moderators and facilitators sit around coming up with abstracts, coming up with questions to drive discussions that they know people are going to find interesting and helpful? Sometimes you just got to give people the room to say and provide their knowledge. I don't want to waste a bunch of time coming up with just the right wording and this, that, and the other, because I think it's going to elicit some kind of response from people. I'm more interested in the driving the conversation in those settings, because I know they're going to say something that's helpful to someone. And I know that they're also going to say something that's going to drive my next question, because there's a sort of on-the-spot navigation that I want to be able to conduct in terms of driving a conversation in surroundings like that, where there's, like, I'm interested in the answers to the questions that I ask. And that oftentimes makes for good questions if you are actually interested in the answer, because I can't tell you the number of times I've seen moderated discussions where the person facilitating the conversation is literally just reading off of a sheet. They don't even understand the question. So they don't know what the answer is supposed to look like or sound like. Those are not good environment. That's not a good environment to be sitting in the audience. And I don't get anything out of that if the moderator isn't vested in the question, the answer to the question. That means the question probably wasn't framed correctly or the moderator doesn't understand the question. They should be curious about the answer to the questions that they ask. And I think that provides a much, much more natural environment in those types of settings. That's what I try and do when I may develop a question set, multiple questions in certain categories, but I also have to leave myself open to the kinds of responses that I get because that may take me off in another direction. I just want to remain curious about the answers and outcomes because I think those are better conversations for folks to be witness to.
You kicked open the door on something else that I wanted to ask you about, so we'll keep going with this energy. How has curiosity played a role in what delivered you where we are today?
It's played a huge role because the older I get, the more I get focused in on how little time I have available, and that time needs to be filled with things that I am interested in. And that interest comes from my desire to learn about something, my desire to explore something that I think is going to result in my own professional development. And that level of curiosity means that I'm asking questions and or leaning into something that I might be uncomfortable with so that I can learn from it and actually get what I think, at least what the proposition is out of a particular experience. I've just always been sort of wired that way. And don't get me wrong, I'm not like some voracious reader or something. I'm not that curious. I know there are people out there who just like every day there are questions. Like, I got to find the answer to this. That's not me. I am curious about certain things. I'm curious as to whether or not I can learn certain things. I'm curious as to how I might perform in certain environments. And so those are the things that tend to grab my attention. Professional performance. Can I learn this? Can I then take what I've learned and then provide some learning to other people about it? Those are the kinds of things I'm interested in. And that's how I spend my time.
Do you think curiosity is a skill that you can improve?
I think once you've seen the value of curiosity, I think you can learn it as a skill. I don't know necessarily the elements that might go into driving someone. A lot of this has to be personality based. Maybe there's a bunch of environmental stuff that goes into it too. Maybe you find out that people who are eminently curious started as readers when they were young. I was a pretty decent reader when I was young. Like I picked up books on my own and read them about topics I was curious about. During my stage of growing up, we had the encyclopedias on a shelf in the home. And I would spend countless time looking up topics that I was interested in and reading about them, whether it be animals. Like every human, I'm interested in, you know, animals and Africa, lions, and their natural environment, and leopards, this, that, and the other, elephants. So if you have a curiosity about these other things, how they live, what the history of it is, how else do you satisfy that curiosity? But by reading and or nowadays you can do Google searches on most of the stuff, or you can use AI to write a paper on it and tell you everything that you ever wanted to know about these topics. Like there is an element. I don't know that it can be taught, but it's definitely a personality trait, the level of curiosity people have and how they satisfy that curiosity in terms of whether it's reading, learning, conducting interviews with people. I'm convinced that for those of us that do podcasts, there's a certain curiosity that we have about whatever topic it is that we've engaged in. And we want to hear other people's opinions on it because it's helping to form our opinion on that. Yeah. On that topic. That's how I approach the topic of leadership. Like I interview people about leadership because I just think there's this bottomless well of experiences. And I'm trying to see as many of those experiences as I can. And one of the ways I'm able to do that is by having conversations with people about it. That's curiosity to me because I want to learn from their experiences.
You had mentioned on the leadership front, I know that you've got this term people-centered leadership.
Yeah.
And so what is a nuance that most people miss about that form of leadership?
The nuance that people miss is that you have to be vested in the growth and professional development of the people for whom you are leading. And that might sound basic, but I can't tell you the number of situations I've been in where that's not apparent. People, I think, misunderstand the nature of the work environment. when someone joins your team, you have those people for a limited period of time, and you have a couple of responsibilities as a leader. One, that you help them grow. You help them identify things that are going to allow them to develop their skills and or deploy their skills in a way that's going to be helpful to the team. And you have an opportunity to help direct them and mentor them if you're open to it, so that you get them ready for their next opportunity. And it's that last piece that I think people grapple with, especially in modern environment. Like, you think that you're going to have this person available to you endlessly. Like, they're going to be available to you for, or, and actually, that's not fair. You think you're going to have them as long as you're there.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So all you think about sometimes is like, what am I going to get done with this group of people that I have here, as opposed to, during the limited time that I'm here, how can I help this group of people become whoever they're supposed to be professionally? Because in doing that, it's my, I like using the term proffer. You know, I attorneys use it for 22 years and now I'm attached to it. I would proffer to people that if you concentrated on the people development part, you would almost always achieve the task-oriented aspect of your job. If you're investing in them, they will produce for you every time, every time. And if you are only concerned with the mission and not their welfare, not their development, you're going to miss the mark almost every time.
And that is heartbreaking from the standpoint that you're working with these folks and this is their life. They only get one life.
Mm-hmm.
And they are spending X number of hours, years with you. And if you're leading them, and you're making life miserable, then what a shame that is.
What waste of time that happens.
Yeah. And like you say, and then if we also miss our goals, it's like, what a disaster. Yeah. Wow.
I believe it or not, not everybody, nothing's universal.
Sure.
But there are a lot of people I think missing this point, that concentrating on the people actually gets you to the mission accomplishment. It gets you there automatically.
Yeah. And so often I hear that stated and it gets a little bit of playtime.
Yeah.
But then when it comes down to actually doing it, the demonstrated or the action, I just see it lacking.
So let me ask you a question. How many times do you think in a work environment, people feel comfortable going to their boss and laying out to them what their career aspirations are, which may include doing something really wonderful on the team that they happen to be on, but the fact that they want to move to either another team or they have aspirations of doing something different? How comfortable do you think people feel in their current work environments to have those kinds of very transparent conversations with their bosses?
What I've witnessed for others in conversations, it's, they do it with a level of risk.
Absolutely. They think, if I have this conversation with my boss and tell them that, you know, my plan is in 12 months that I've done enough here that I'm going to move to another team, or I'm going to put in for promotion, and that promotion may be with another team, like, you immediately think to yourself, well, the boss is now going to be not interested in me as an employee.
Yeah.
And by being not interested in me, that means they're not going to nourish me. They're not going to support me. They could care less what happens to me. And oh, by the way, if there's some trimming that needs to happen, they're probably going to look to me because I've told them that I intend to leave the team at some point. What a fearful environment for people to live in. What a fearful environment. Now, I don't know if this comes from my time in the military where you operate on like 3 and 4 year cycles. I don't know where it comes from. I will tell you that as a professional, my entire career, I have a 4 to 5 year clock on any one particular job. When I hit the 4 year mark, my eyes start shifting and I start wondering what's next. Because as in the earlier part of the conversation I described to you, I might have ventured into an area that originally I didn't feel comfortable with. But I will tell you, after 4 years, not only am I comfortable, I've mastered whatever it was that I came there to do. And when I've mastered something, I'm ready for the next challenge. And I need for people to understand that. My wife hates it, by the way. It drives her nuts. Because it's like clockwork. 4 years, 4 and a half. Like, I start, I'm like, what's next for me? I'm trying to grow, develop, move on to the next thing. And because I'm like that, I recognize it in other people too. And I actually try and nourish it because I understand it. Like, I can't be that way and then have someone be on a team that I lead and not nourish that in someone else. And I've seen it in other people. And my job immediately, if I see that in a person that's on my team, my job is to help them get to that next point they're trying to get to. Even if that's not with my team, I'm interested in their outcome as a professional. Not, I don't know, the widget's going to get made. It's going to ship. Believe me, people are going to love it. Revenue is going to go up like a hockey stick. But at the end of the day, these people like rely on you're investing and you're a part of like this major portion of their lives. You know, 8 to 9 hours a day, sometimes longer, people are spending in work environments. Like, be good to people. Help them. It comes back to you in really amazing and rewarding ways if you help them get to where they want to be. Don't be so focused on getting recognized for shipping product X. No one cares at the end of the day. In a year, no one will remember that you were the person assigned to deliver that product. I guarantee you, no one will. I don't care how many emails you sent out about this amazing thing that you did. No one will remember that you were the principal on that project. But if they had a poor interaction with you, I bet you they remember that.
That's the conversation that I had with my last team with the Navy. We would talk about the fact that you're going to move. We got the band together right now, but right. The band is going to disband as people take options. And it's like, what can I do to help you get there? Yeah. What kind of experiences do you need such that you now can check a box and make you more lucrative,
viable
to
for that
whomever
opportunity.
Else?
Yeah. Viable for that opportunity. And that's not going to happen always on schedule, right? That you can't schedule those times when someone on your team gets presented with that next opportunity. But what you can do is you can help them prepare for it, knowing that it's going to come at some point. And you've done all you could to prepare them for the next thing that's going to help them level up their career. I'm interested in seeing people succeed. At the end of the day, if that's your focus, if you're interested in seeing other people succeed, you can't lose. But if you're interested in like stifling someone or you feel bothered or offended by their ambition or whatever it is that they're doing to improve themselves, that's about you. That's not about them. Mm.
Well stated. You state reflection is a key component of leadership development. What roles do questions and inquiry play in that process of leadership development, reflection for leadership development?
Yeah, it plays a massive role because I think in those moments of reflection, you need to be asking yourself really hard questions that you may not even feel comfortable sharing with other people. In the moments of reflection that I experience, whether I'm journaling digitally or writing into a journal, which I do both, I have to ask myself if I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing in any one particular thing that I write about. And sometimes the answer is no. Right? Sometimes the answer is I didn't do that as well as I could, as well as I could have. You know, I had a rough interaction with someone. What role did I play, or my baggage or my positioning in that scenario? What role did I play in that? And I don't always have the hard answer. But I know I did because there was two people involved in the scenario. It didn't just happen out of thin air. It can be hard to voluntarily admit that you were wrong about something. And even more challenging, I think, to actually go back and try and have a conversation with someone you may have had a poor interaction with and try and square the lines on that. That's hard stuff. I don't care what anybody says. It's hard to do. We don't always get it right. You want to strive and try and get those kinds of things right when they do happen. But asking yourself really hard questions about your role in any one particular thing. And there's a saying out there, I don't get it right, but I know that the essence of the saying is you and the decisions that you've made are ultimately responsible for everything that you're experiencing in life right now. Like, I absolutely believe that. Mm-hmm. I think that whether it's a sequence of events, occurrences, decisions you've made, whatever it is that you're experiencing in life right now, is the result of decisions and actions that you made or did not make along a pathway in life that resulted in you ending up exactly where you are. And for some people, that's a great thing. Some people are experiencing wild success and they can look back on the lineage of the decisions that they made and know that that's the result of it. whereas other people, I think, are in bad situations. And it's hard, I think, especially in those situations, for people to understand the role they may have played in that.
Your journals, do you go back and review them? What is your process for how you use those?
I've gotten sloppy over the years. And I say sloppy because I started journaling at 18 when I went to the Naval Academy Prep School. It was literally my first time at 18 away from home. And I had actually, I'd done some form of journaling. Like I used to write stories as a kid. I was really into science fiction. I used to write these science fiction stories. So I had already gotten into the practice of sort of writing down thoughts, imagination, and ideas. But when I went away to college, I picked up a journal. I don't remember. No one told me to buy one. I literally saw one probably in a drugstore and grabbed the journal, or maybe even at the Base Exchange in Newport, Rhode Island. I picked up a journal and I just started writing it. I just started capturing what was for me at the time a very difficult time. You know, again, first time away from home, really hard academic setting, but it's like, this is what I signed up for. I wanted to go to school here. Like this is, so it's wrestling with, here's the decision I've made. It's really hard. How do I reconcile my decision to do something really hard with what my reality is on the ground? And I've been journaling again off and on since the age of 18, and I find it immensely helpful. And the reason I say I've gotten sloppy about it is because I used to journal like really frequently, and now it's more sporadic. And I think, if I'm being honest, I think that's because I've achieved a certain level of success and I don't have as many challenges as I used to. Mm. And journaling comes from challenges. Like when you're being challenged and life's like kind of kicking you in the tail, that's when you want to document and write about it. What escapes me is that, and I say again, sloppy, like I should be capturing the good stuff too. Like I've had a lot of great things happen to me over the past two decades, maybe. And not all of that is documented in a way that it should be. These are things that you can turn over. My father journaled and he passed away many years ago, but I have his journals and I can go back and read those journals now to understand his mindset. These are conversations that he and I did not have at the time he's writing this stuff. But now it gives me better insight into his line of thinking, the challenges he was facing. I keep telling myself, now that AI is available, I think I'm going to turn it into a book. Yeah, it's extremely helpful. I guess my point is maybe one day my kids will go through these journals and extract some better understanding of who their dad was.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Cool. As we start to head towards closing up the conversation, a question that I ask folks is, what is your right now question? So this would be a question that you're working with right now that's beyond what's for dinner and who am I going to get married to or anything like that. So what questions are you currently wrestling with or they're having an impact in your life?
That's a great question. I think I've only said that 100 times since we started this conversation. You know what I'm wrestling with? I'm wrestling with have I done enough to go venture off on my own? Am I prepared? Have I done enough? Am I ready to go off and sort of put my own shingle and do my own thing? And I grapple. Some days, if you catch me, I'm like, I'm ready. I'm ready to venture off. And then other days you catch me, I'm like, I'm not sure. Have I socked away enough money? Have I done all of the things that I need to do in order to prepare for an opportunity like that? I wrestle with it and I don't have the exact answer to it at the moment. But for me, maybe this is natural. Being a proponent of leadership as a discipline, I've always thought that one day I would run my own business. Only recently have I started to create a vision as to what that's going to look like. So implementing and executing that vision is part of the thing that I'm engaged in at the moment. At some point, I'll take a leap of faith. I'll burn the ships at the shore, use all appropriate analogies or insert all appropriate analogies. At some point, I'm going to take the leap, but I do question whether or not I'm ready for it.
Wow. All right. Well, I'll let that one just sit and marinate. Are there any elements of questions that we hadn't covered down on that you thought, I'd like to talk about this?
No, first of all, I applaud you because I think this is a super, super interesting area to invest your time, effort, and expertise in, developing and otherwise. I do believe that there is value in formulation, understanding, again, interview skills and talking to people. There's expertise to be developed in that. I think this is a super interesting area to be involved in, and I sense and feel the curiosity that you have associated with it. I think those are great. It's a great area to be engaged in because I think there's value in it to learn from it. But as you and I have also discussed, I also think that it's the seed to lots of other things, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like if you can be a person who formulates good questions, that will lead to all of these other great things in this one particular area or various areas where you may happen to be engaged. And so that for me is the part that's the stickiness where I'm like super interested with you in terms of this particular topic. I just think it seeds and finds itself in so many different areas. And I think that your approach is rather novel. And I just hope folks are listening and following your podcast and the website and everything and just really thinking about how they can benefit from some of these conversations that you have.
Wow. Thank you. I'm absolutely grateful for your support. That is for sure. I appreciate your enthusiasm for questions. Now, for those that would love to see what you're working on or understand what you're excited about, where is the best place for folks to track you down?
Absolutely, LinkedIn. I am a prolific user of LinkedIn. I've gotten very comfortable at expressing my thoughts and ideas on there. I have a newsletter called the Leadership Student Newsletter, where each month, at least once or twice, I'll sit down and journal and jot out leadership concepts and things that I think other people can gain use from. So I'd encourage people definitely connect with me on LinkedIn if you're interested or follow, because I'm covering down a lot of stuff. Sometimes it's cybersecurity related. Other times it's leadership related. Sometimes it might be just how we all need to be in a growth mindset and getting better at whatever it is that we're doing.
Sweet. All right. That's a wrap, my friend. Thank you. I appreciate you coming on to Curated Questions.
Yeah, you bet.
Ken here. I gained many insights from MK and will have to re-listen to capture everything. Here are four I zeroed in on. How do they compare with your list? Number one, the power of strategic silence in questioning. MK emphasized that the secret to interviewing is knowing when to shut up and listen. He learned from FBI training that people are inherently uncomfortable with silence and that will often volunteer crucial information to fill that void. Rather than rushing to ask the next question, skilled questioners create space for deeper responses by becoming comfortable with uncomfortable pauses. This technique allows the person being questioned to process and often reveal more than they initially intended. Question: how can you incorporate strategic pauses into your next vital conversation to allow for deeper, more authentic responses? Number two, the counterintuitive relationship between mastery and restlessness. MK described a 4-year internal clock where his comfort with mastery actually triggers his desire for new challenges. This reveals a nuanced understanding that peak performance often comes just before the urge to move on. Rather than viewing this restlessness as a character flaw, he recognizes it as a growth signal and helps others on his team prepare for their own inevitable transitions. Question: how can you recognize when your own mastery is creating restlessness, and how might you channel that energy into preparing for your next growth phase? Number three, the foundation of psychological safety through questioning. MK discovered that effective questioning requires creating an environment where people feel safe to share information. In FBI interviews, success came not from aggressive interrogation tactics, but from building trust and demonstrating that shared information would be handled appropriately. This principle applies equally to leadership and business settings. People only open up when they trust a questioner's intention and integrity. Question: what steps can you take to establish psychological safety before asking difficult or probing questions in your professional relationships? Number four, people-centered questions that drive performance. MK emphasizes that leaders who focus on developing their team members rather than just completing tasks consistently achieve better outcomes. The key insight is asking team members about their career aspirations and growth goals, even if those goals involve leaving the team. By concentrating on people development through thoughtful questioning about their futures, leaders naturally accomplish their mission objectives. Question: how can you regularly ask your team members about their career aspirations and growth goals, even when those conversations might feel uncomfortable? Congratulations, friends, you've made it to the end of another episode. To those on the other side of the speakers, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.